My guest here today is Anthony DeVroy, violist of the award-winning Avalon String Quartet, and today they're celebrating the release of a new album on Sadi Records called Leo Sowerby, The Paul Whiteman Commissions and Other Early Works. Anthony, congratulations on the release of this new album. I'm sure you're very excited.
It is very exciting. This is a great project to work on, a unique project for us, and a real musical discovery for us. So it was a real silver lining in an otherwise challenging year for all of us.
Well, I look forward to talking about the pieces on the album that the Avalon String Quartet recorded. But first, I'd like to start with the man himself, Leo Sowerby. And by the way, it is Sowerby and not Sowerby. I had one of those monologuing moments on the radio the other day, like you do, and I was going back and forth. I couldn't decide. But it's indeed Sowerby. I normally talk to musicians who are performing right here in Kalamazoo area, but this seems local to me because Mr. Sowerby was born in Grand Rapids, Michigan, which is just 45 miles away.
That's right. He's from your area. I think his family moved to Chicago when he was around 10, and he ended up studying there and making most of his professional career there. But he is Grand Rapids born, and certainly always felt a strong connection to the Great Lakes region.
This album is actually part of a series that Sadi Records has released, putting the focus on Leo Sowerby. In fact, they've paid attention to his music for a few decades, actually. When I played the Lincoln Trio's Sowerby recording earlier this summer on my program, I went to Wikipedia, I looked at Leo Sowerby's bio, and nowhere did it say he spent time in New York with the jazz age scene and writing for the Paul Whiteman Band.
Yeah, it's really remarkable that he was part of that same original Whiteman tour that produced Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. So he was writing for the same structure of band, the exact same personnel that Gershwin had written for. And I think this was kind of a phase for Sowerby. He sort of struck up a relationship with Whiteman and was drawn to the whole idea of bringing jazz into the concert hall. And so, of course, the jazz orchestra music very strongly has that sound, but it also carried into some of, at least for a time, it carried over into some of his other works in that period and beyond. And this was relatively early in his career. So the chamber music works on this CD that has come out are from the late 19-teens, early 1920s. Mm-hmm. 1920s, that was the time that he was involved with Whiteman and was commissioned by Whiteman. So all these pieces, though very different in their scoring, are from the same era and reflect some similar impulses, some similar attractions to him in his music, some similar things that he wanted to be trying out.
He was favorably compared to Igor Stravinsky in his day. And this all somehow speaks to me to the fact that Sowerby had a huge depth and skills to apply in a lot of directions.
Yeah, really a remarkable musician. He ended up composing hundreds and hundreds of scores. People like to say that he wrote for all genres except for opera and ballet. Those were two things that he never really dipped his toe into. But of course, there's a very in the Whiteman pieces, and you know, this carries over into his abstract music, there's definitely a sort of a storytelling capability or a picture painting capability that I think could have served those other genres if he had wanted to, but he really never turned his attention that way. But he wrote lots of chamber music for all different combinations, lots of instrumental works. And then, of course, as his career progressed and as he got really formally ensconced in church music, that was what got most of his attention, was organ and choral music, to the point that he came to be known as the Dean of American Sacred Music, and one of his choral works won the Pulitzer Prize in the 1940s, and that was how he really found his main calling in music. But he was prolific. He worked broadly and quickly and deeply, and just produced an extraordinary range and variety of music.
So his talent was extremely broad. He wrote hundreds and hundreds of pieces. And yet today, it's up to ensembles like you and Sidi Records to kind of bring a Sowerby Renaissance around. What can you point to in our lack of consciousness about Sowerby these days?
Yeah, it's really interesting to try to figure out, you know, how lives and careers take different turns and end up in different places. I mean, if you think about Sowerby and Gershwin at the same time writing music for the same Paul Whiteman project, the same tour, and one of those pieces took off like a meteor, and the other one sort of, drifted into obscurity. I think that Sowerby was just, you know, not too committed of a self-promoter. I think he was a modest guy. I mean, I think he was confident in his abilities, but just didn't feel compelled to strike out for a superstar career or to make his mark in that way. I think he felt very connected to Chicago. He certainly struck up a strong relationship with the Chicago Symphony and with local musicians in our region. I think at least part of it was just he didn't seem to have the urge to try to make a Gershwin size or Stravinsky size name for himself in the legacy of his music.
Right. And next to Sowerby, Gershwin really looks like a pop's composer. Writing
right.
Very attractive tunes, whereas what I hear in Sowerby is he's just not afraid of complex chords, complex progressions. There's a lot of beauty, but he's not aiming for the American songbook.
No, he's not. Although, when you survey the different pieces on this disc, again, just the variety within these works for the same instrumentation within the chamber works, there's the serenade in G major, which is that actually was published during his life, and that was a piece that kind of helped put him on the map in his early years. Very breezy, very kind of free-spirited and fun-loving piece. And to me, I hear some Americana in the harmony, just, you know, the open fifths, just the very bright bright harmonies and broad phrasing to the piece. And then you compare that to the density of the quartet number one, which we ought to talk about in just a minute, because that was a whole different beast of its own to put together. And then when you compare both of those with the tramping tune for piano, string quartet, and bass, this is one version of a piece that exists in a couple of different versions, which is just kind of a raucous parody of a piece. Again, coming back to this idea of the versatility, the variety of the writing is really amazing. So the detail that I want to bring up about the context that I want to bring up about the string quartet number one is that this piece was not published. The way Sowerby worked was to create what he called a pencil sketch of each piece, which is just notes written in pencil. Every single note in the piece, no articulations, very little dynamics, very little indications about the music apart from the notes. So that was called the pencil sketch. Then he would go back and create an ink sketch, which was the same notes, but also filled in with all the musical details. And then that is what would be prepared for printing and for publication. So somewhere along the way, the ink sketch to the string quartet number one disappeared. We're not exactly sure what happened to it, but all we had to work with was this pencil sketch, or more accurately, the Leo Sowerby Foundation prepared a printed version of the pencil sketch for us to work with, which was certainly easier than trying to read someone's handwriting.
You had the task of filling in indications, emotional content.
Tempi, dynamics, articulations, phrasing, voicing of the music, yeah, everything about it was just kind of a blank slate. And, you know, this was a composer that we didn't have background with, apart from the other works we were studying for this disc. So it was a real excavation, unlike anything that we've tried before. Very challenging, very frustrating experience, but also in the end, you know, we had to just sort of take a step and try something. And certainly there were a lot of things that we tried that we ended up discarding along the way, but the idea of just like, you can't just play notes. You have to commit to something about the musical style and about the technical approach to how, as performers, you're actually going to play the piece. And a lot of that was just kind of educated guessing, kind of trial and error. We had some back and forth with some former students of Sowerby's and Sowerby scholars, and we felt very supported and encouraged by their reactions to what we were coming up with as we were doing the work. So you know, that felt good, that felt reassuring. But ultimately, we're never really going to know exactly how close, unless that ink sketch to the piece turns up under someone's, you know, bed sheets somewhere or something. we're ultimately never going to know exactly what he had in mind for those various factors. But, you know, we did our best with what we had. It was a fascinating experience. And now, working with the Leo Sowerby Foundation, we're planning to create performing versions of this quartet, and hopefully we'll get a chance to give the same treatment to his string quartet number two, because these are great American string quartets from a time that there aren't all that many great American string quartets, and it's really worth having in the repertoire and having them available for performance.
My guest is Tony DeVroy, violist with the Avalon String Quartet, celebrating the release of Leo Sowerby, the Paul Whiteman Commissions, and other early works today on Sedee Records. And to wrap up, Tony, I'd just like to observe that this music wouldn't be available to WMUK, to any listener, without the dedication of both the group, which you just gave us a small glimpse into the work required, as well as the record label. And it seems to me this kind of dedication and devotion to not a profitable composer is rare these days. I so appreciate that the repertoire is being expanded in a project like this.
Yeah, there's extraordinary advocacy going on behind us, and we're grateful to be a part of it.
Can you give us any hints about the Avalon String Quartet perhaps performing outside of the Chicago area sometime in the next year or two?
Well, we've been connected to the White Lake Chamber Music Festival, which is just a little ways north of you, for a number of summers. Now, we just wrapped up a week of concerts there, and we intend to go back there next summer. It's a beautiful area, and we've enjoyed a long relationship with them, really getting to know the area and getting to know the music lovers up there. And that's kind of a summer destination for us every year. So hope you'll find us there.
Okay. Well, is there any final thought you wanted to share with our listeners about this new release?
Just that there is extraordinary stuff out there that's just slightly under the radar. And, you know, if it is brought just enough to the surface, there are amazing discoveries to be made and real love and inspiration to be found.
Well, I'm going to give our listeners a taste of this album right now. Thank you so much for chatting with me.
Thank you, Kara.